This morning, I'm just going to set the scene, set the context for the rest of the retreat. And I'm going to start by reading a translation of the sutta, which I don't have with me. Has anyone got their translation with them?
Yep.
Dhammadasa, thank you. The Dasadharma Sutta. Friends, there are 10 dharmas that should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. What are these 10? I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. My very life is sustained by the gifts of others. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I should strive to abandon my former habits. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Could my spiritual companions find fault with my conduct? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do for good or ill, of that I shall be heir. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Do I delight in solitude or not? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Have I experienced any profound truth or wise insights, so that when facing death I need not feel ashamed when questioned by my spiritual companions? These should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Friends, these are the 10 dharmas, to be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. So the first thing I'll do this morning is I'll talk about the sutta. I'll have a short introduction to the sutta. Then I'm going to talk very briefly about what paradigms are. Then I'm going to talk about paradigms as the source of systems. Then I'm going to talk about the order as a system. And then I'm going to talk about how change happens, how the order is well placed to promote change, and then some. I want to say some things about views. You'll be delighted to know most of these sections are quite brief. So if you want more detail, it's out there and I can tell you where to find it. But I'm just going to, it's just an introduction. So to start talking about the sutta, it is a very traditional sutta, and it's framed in a way for the instruction for the monastic community. As I said last night, we looked at 3 different translations and also some reflections written by Subhuti, which he used with the order in India, based on this sutta. I haven't been able to find any commentaries on this sutta, so this is ours. This retreat is our commentary on this sutta. So that'll be interesting. The sutta is a series of reflections which help us sharpen our practice and bring into focus the cultural views that we challenge because of our commitment to the 3 jewels. As it does begin, friends, there are 10 dharmas that should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Although the members of the order are not monastic in a traditional sense, we all have gone forth. And in the next few days, with the help of this sutta, I hope it will become clearer just what we have gone forth from and to what extent. The first reflection is all-embracing, and in its most traditional translation, it talks about becoming casteless. And in another translation, it talks about changing to a different mode of life. And Subhuti talks about being free from group identity. Caste was also a dominant force in the Buddha's time. Despite this, the Buddha seems singularly disinterested in the caste system and treats it as irrelevant. In the Adana's Upasatha Sutta, he says, "Just as whatever great rivers there are, on reaching the great ocean, lose their former names and identities and are just called the great ocean, so also those of the four castes, nobles, Brahmins, merchants and workers, having gone forth from home to the homeless state in the Dharma and discipline made known by the Tathagata, abandon their former names and identities and are just called recluses, the followers of the Shakya clan." The Buddha recognized that the labeling and pinning down of the place and the role of monk or nun previously occupied in society was completely irrelevant to their spiritual life. As followers of the Shakya Sun ourselves, we turn away from mainstream society and its preoccupations at the time of our ordination. We place going for refuge at the centre of our lives and mark this change with a change of our names. This is a very strong symbolic act, not only for us, but for those around us. Being casteless is a huge step into the unknown in India. I was ordained in India and heard a lot about my Indian sisters' stories of their path into the order. They really are all shuris. They're all heroines. They have a tremendous struggle against prevailing ideology and group values. One woman on my retreat was beaten up by her family. Another threatened with being put out on the street without support and protection, a very dangerous situation for women in India. All because these women step outside the assumption that everyone must have a caste, which is a fundamental paradigm of Indian society. It's the accepted norm. In the sutta, the following nine reflections, like the precepts, are the more detailed explanation of the first. We will not be studying them one by one, but through different aspects of our spiritual life and the paradigms they challenge. The Buddha taught the way from wrong view to right view, and then the way to perfect view, the seeing through views altogether. And the order is there to support us in this most difficult undertaking. And I'd like to share with you just one way of looking how it can do this through the lens of paradigm and systems thinking. So I just want to say a couple of things about the concepts of paradigms and systems thinking. It's important not to see them as things in themselves. They're more like lenses through which that we see the view the patterns of being in the world around us in a different light. So in this context, well, in any context probably, they are concepts to be treated more like symbols. They're fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the thing itself. They're just indicators. So just going to say what paradigms are. Paradigms are the shared ideas in the minds of society, the big unstated assumptions. All societies have paradigms, and they are the deepest set of views and beliefs about how the world works. Paradigms are the source of systems, and they hold the shared agreements about the nature of reality. So they hold the shared agreements about the nature of reality. And they are unstated because it is unnecessary to state them. Everybody already knows them. For example, this is real simplification. Okay, so for example, the market economy is a system. It's a complex relationship of interaction which connects people who have something to sell with people who have a wish to buy. And the purpose behind it is to maximize profits and to make money. One of the underlying assumptions which enable the market economy to work is money. This is a £10 note. And there is an understanding that this particular piece of paper is worth £10. When this particular piece of paper gets very crumpled and dirty and falls on the floor, it does not become litter. It does not lose the value that society attributes to it. And every time we use money in an exchange of goods or services, we are acting on this paradigm. This shared idea in the collective mind of our society, this unstated assumption about this piece of paper, that it has intrinsic worth. So paradigms are the source of systems. The economic system is supported by the view that money measures something real and has real meaning. This is a paradigm. This assumption that money is real and has intrinsic value leads to lots of other assumptions. For example, it can lead to the assumption that people who are paid less are literally worth less. So I'm going to tell you very briefly what a system is now. So very simply, the system is a set of parts or things, and these can make up a cell in our body, a musical instrument, what makes the weather, a production line, the House of Commons, all of those are systems. These things are held together by connections, and because of the nature of these connections, they behave in a particular way. And the way that the system behaves is governed by its internal purpose or core value, which is at the heart of the system. This kind of system thinking is a branch of mathematics and also a way of looking at the world. And it has a much greater overlap with traditional Buddhist teachings than previous mainstream scientific models. It's a modern concept that is more closely aligned to Pratītasamuppāda than any other previous scientific model. And I have a particular interest in thinking in systems because I think it helps us to see the world as conditioned rather than causal. And they're very different things. When we look at the world as a series of systems, it frees us from the idea that one thing directly causes another. It helps us look at the complex relationship of interactions that are present at all times and at all levels of existence. I now want to talk a bit about seeing the order as a system. In systems terms, the internal goal or purpose of the order is the movement towards enlightenment, the ideal of stream entry and beyond within this lifetime. In systems terms, the interconnectivity is provided by Kalyanamitrita and the institutions of the order that support Kalyanamitrita. Chapters, conveners at all level, the International Order Office team, the college, as well as individual friendships, and the free association of individuals through leading retreats, studying together, meeting in large numbers, and occasionally playing football. In systems terms, the parts of the order are the members who have undergone training, have developed relationships, and enter the order through their effective going for refuge being recognised. I have a very deep respect for the way that Sangharakshita has set up the order as a unique organisation. I believe he set up the Triratna Buddhist Order in a very visionary way. It's a unique organisation in that it is not organised in any way that is familiar to us. He established the order to be freely aligned through conditionality, Pratītasamuppāda. The order comes into being in dependence on conditions, and the fundamental conditions are the effectiveness of our going for refuge, our commitment to the lineage of practice and Kalyanamitrita. These are the basis of our interconnectedness. It's what holds the order together. The order does not conform to our cultural understandings of what an organisation is. We don't have a power hierarchy. It is not a bureaucracy, and nor does it conform to democratic principles. Because we cannot fit it into any normal way of thinking about organisations, the true nature of the order can be difficult to see. I believe that the order in itself is a new paradigm of organisation. I believe the order is pratita samapada in the realms of the lived spiritual life. Its conditionality in the service of enlightenment, unmediated by the organisational concepts of westernised society.
Sorry, could you just say that again?
Well, hold that bit. Yeah, that in bit. So the order in itself is a new paradigm of organisation. I believe the order is pratita samapada in the realms of the lived spiritual life. It is conditionality in the service of enlightenment, unmediated by the organisational concepts of Western society. That's why we're so fab.
To hear it again.
Yeah. So I'm now going to talk about changing paradigms. Changing paradigms causes all sorts of problems. As I mentioned earlier, our Indian brothers and sisters who convert to Buddhism have a hard time of it. They can be bullied, beaten, or ostracized for merely having a different way of life and set of beliefs. The Buddhist community in India is very different from the wider society. It tends to have a higher level of education. Women tend to have more choices in their lives, and on the whole, they are more affluent than the communities that they were born into. Such is the strength of paradigm change that it can bring real and fundamental differences, and at the same time, retribution and punishment from those who wish to maintain the old paradigm. When Galileo decided that the world was no longer flat, the Catholic Church banged him up and forbid him for teaching. And it wasn't till 1992 until they apologised about his treatment. Such is the strength of paradigms. When we join the order, because we see the need to change in different ways and on all levels, all kinds of levels. For anyone to move from an ordinary life to having going for refuge at the centre of their being, this is a change of paradigm, a shift of ideas and assumptions about what is meaningful and important. To keep going for refuge at the centre of our lives, we need the supportive conditions within the order. Changing paradigms is one of the most difficult things you can choose to do. Sometimes all it takes is a click of the mind, a new way of seeing, but on the whole, paradigms are hard to change. Changing paradigms means turning our backs on the familiar, which is difficult to do. And to those who are near and dear to us, our changing perspectives and actions are often confusing and sometimes threatening to the status quo. And the desire to live a spiritual life can seem simply incomprehensible to society at large. To grow and keep changing, we need our spiritual friends, people who understand what we are trying to do, to keep pointing out the anomalies and failures of the old paradigms. I think one of the most remarkable qualities of the order is that we recognise the strength and necessity of turning towards and looking at unsettling or difficult situations rather than denying them or running away. Bhante says in Crossing the Stream, only when a man feels strongly will he act effectively. It is for this reason, above all others, that Buddhism starts out with not a concept, but with a feeling. Not with intellectual postulation, but with emotional experience. This is the very important, ill-fitting chariot wheel of dukkha. And it's often the precursor to change. In systems terms, it's known as an instability within the system. This instability, discomfort, or distress is seen as the driver for adaptation, creativity and learning. Kalyana Mitrata is also crucial as it allows us to support each other through the discomfort of change. I just want to make clear that participation is in the order is important for it to be effective in this manner. Systems cannot function well without good networks of communication, and to the degree order members do not participate, then the system or the order can be undermined. The order relies on its members to exercise personal responsibility for this, and to drop out of communication with the order is to risk the order's effective functioning. So I'm just going to say something now about how change happens. Change can happen on any number of levels. On an individual level, we can change our habits or understandings. A community can change the way it educates its children, or a society can change its political system. Deep-seated, lasting change in systems terms follows a particular pattern, whatever the level is. A systems understanding does not talk about straightforward cause and effect, but looks at the conditions needed for change to take place. And because now I'm speaking about the order, I'll talk about this in the context of individual change and ethical sensibility. The practice of ethics as a whole contains a change of paradigm, as Bantu would say, from the power mode to the love mode. Ethics within the order is an expression of our going for refuge. And here I'm going to talk about confession as an example of how change happens within the system that is the individual order member. As order members, we have a particular level of understanding and a desire to refine our ethical way of life as a way of living closer to the way things are. Although we can only change ourselves, our ethical practice is supported by our connection with the order as a system. In the order, we're committed to helping each other become more and more ethical. So in the order, the individual ethics have a collective dimension. In confession, several conditions need to be present. A friend with whom we have a Kalyana Mitra relationship, or a member of our chapter, someone with whom we have a shared understanding of the principles involved. There needs to be trust in others that they have our interests at heart, and a transparency of communication. So in systems terms, this is a free flow of information. There's no blockage to it. From the point of view of the order member confessing, there is not only an ethical breach, but a desire to change behaviour. Importantly, to do this effectively, there needs to be an emotional discomfort that creates the desire to change. This can either come from the desire to confess something that they've done, or be triggered by a challenge from another order member about a certain behaviour. This, in systems terms, is called feedback. It's information that something is inconsistent with the principle of the system, in this case, the order's principle of ethical behaviour. In the order, we would know this emotional discomfort as hri or apatrapia, positive shame. This disturbance or instability in the individual that is the order member does not have to be bad. It's not bad. There's no judgment on it whatsoever. But it is unsettling to that person. For the confession to be heard effectively, it needs to be taken seriously by those who hear it. The instability is recognised as important information for the system. Information is then circulated about this disturbance in order to keep the order's meaning or values, and there is listening and discussion. The deep principle of the order, not avoiding the uncomfortable, is recognised both by those who act through the shared principle of Kalyana Mitrata. Consistent and kindly support can be offered to their brother and sister in the order to enable change to happen. From this, there is a breakthrough. Something has to give, leading to creativity and change. These may be new understandings or values or patterns of behaviour, and ethical sensibility can be strengthened. On the level of society, this can be perhaps better seen with hindsight. I recently watched a film about the work of William Wilberforce and the work he did in bringing about the end of slavery. He, with others, instigated the patterns of conditions that brought about the change in the 18th and 19th centuries. Wilberforce was a Member of Parliament, and he also worked with abolitionists and the House of Commons. He was personally deeply distressed by the slave trade and sought for many years to communicate the facts of this trade, and encouraging former slaves to write their experiences. He organised mass letters to public support to newspapers, and he brought into being the very first grassroots human rights campaign. He worked tirelessly for public awareness, and men and women of all social classes and backgrounds committed themselves to abolishing the slave trade, including the then Prime Minister Pitt the Younger. In systems terms, he worked through establishing a free flow of information through society. He brought about the questioning of the status quo through grassroots-supported groups. He was an early networker. He used emotionally charged language and the testimonials of slaves to bring about emotional discomfort about the treatment of other human beings. This was eventually taken seriously, leading to the passing of the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833. It took up his entire life from the age of 27 to when he died at 74, just 3 days after the bill was passed. I think he just waited to relinquish the life force. You know, I think things like that happen sometimes, yeah. Sorry?
Dr.
Yeah, absolutely. When he'd done what he needed to do, he could die. He was ill for most of his life. Anyway, he did as Thomas Kuhn said 160 years later in The Structure of the Scientific Revolutions. You keep pointing on at the anomalies and failures in the old paradigm. You keep speaking and acting loudly and with assurance from the new one. You assert the new paradigm in places of public visibility and power. You don't waste time with reactionaries. Rather, you work with the active change agents and with the vast middle ground of people who are open-minded. Fantastic. He's just got it. It's great. Once we think once we have a bigger picture, we can see this kind of change all around us. So I just thought of some things in my own lifetime. Okay, drink driving goes from a bit of bravado to being totally unacceptable. It's driven by the free flow of information on deaths on the roads, lots of public publicity, a change in the law, and new technology, the breathalyzer. So those are the sort of conditions that help that come into being. The delightful and wonderful recent referendum on gay marriage in Southern Ireland, huge social change and a noticeable lessening of the influence of the Catholic Church. Really happy about that. And the big ones in my lifetime, the things I'd never thought happened, the fall of the Berlin Wall. I saw it on television, couldn't believe it. And the end of apartheid, you know, Nelson Mandela walking out of prison. They were all created in this way, this kind of meaningful working against the status quo to create change. It's hard, but it can work. So in all these situations, there's a coming together of people who are distressed by a situation, emotionally involved. They tell their stories, they risk their lives, they get the information out there, they form networks, they seek support until something gives. The system breaks down or there is a breakthrough. Donella Meadows, who's my favourite system scientist, who unfortunately she's dead, talked about the power of paradigm change when she said, "It is the space of mastery over paradigms that people throw off addictions and live in constant joy, bring down empires, get locked up or burned at the stake or crucified or shot, and have impacts that last for millennia." I now want to talk about how the order is well placed to promote change, paradigm change. Let's have a little drink.
You got enough?
Yeah, that's fine, thanks. As followers of the Shakya Sun in the context of the order, it's good to remember that the order's principles and practices are largely based on the rejection of society's dominant values. With the support of the order, we can start to change paradigms. We move away from the accepted understandings of the culture we are embedded in as we more fully embody the understandings of the Dharma. Bhante says in The Yogi's Joy, "It is easy to forget that the Buddhist message is a subversive one, that its values run counter to mundane or worldly norms, and that your commitment to its ethical principles may lead you to, on occasion, to offend conventional notions of morality. The work we undertake when we join and practice in the order is the strenuous work of transformation. With the help of others in the order, we question our views and assumptions and face the disquiet of deep change. The order does this by supporting our effective going for refuge and enabling it to move towards real going for refuge. The order as practice is to open yourself up to the effect of the order and also help the order constantly raise its game to become more than the sum of its parts and allow the bodhicitta to arise. To do this, we need to leave behind the values and preoccupations of our westernized society, the paradigms that we are familiar with. We have to replace these unstated assumptions with a new paradigm, the paradigm of the spiritual life, embodied in and supported by the order. In the order, we can constantly transcend our views, our conditioning and our personality. We can move from wrong to right view. We can increasingly align ourselves with reality. So this is what the Dasadharma Sutta is asking us to reflect on. The move from wrong to right view. The deep fundamental changes in the way that we perceive the world and our place in it, which takes place through our practice, through our going for refuge. In 1971, Sangharakshita gave a lecture called Evolution and Extinction, a Buddhist view of current world problems, snappy title. And one part of the lecture, he talks about the individual's responsibility for the way the world is and the role of the spiritual community in promoting change. He talks about the potential of the spiritual community being like an earthworm, undermining the existing order and shifting the governing values of the world.
Read it again.
Like an earthworm, undermining the existing order and shifting the governing values of the world. Engagement with the wider society by the order is actually enhanced by two things. We are embedded in it, and we are also distinct from it at the same time. In systems terms, we're a nested holon, which is very sweet. So, these things together... Sorry.
Nested what?
Holon.
H-O-L-O-N. You're a colon.
So the fact that we're embedded in society and we are distinct from it at the same time give us this ability to challenge cultural assumptions through spreading the Dharma. We have to remember and honour the fact that we have a distinct and relevant alternative way at looking at the world. And at the same time, it's important we are not absorbed into mainstream society. And we don't have to stop there. Not only is the order a means by which we can support each other to move from wrong to right view, but it's in itself a full practice of right view. It embodies an operational concept of pratita samapada in the lived spiritual life, devoid of the paradigms of the world around us. When, with the support of the order, we open ourselves up to perfect view, and we can open ourselves up to insight, leaving... I'll read that again. With the support of the order, we can open ourselves up to right view and can also open ourselves up to insight, leaving view behind altogether. When we understand deeply the reality of conditioned existence, we know that it is indeed painful, impermanent, and insubstantial instead of the opposite. When we leave behind the three lakshanas, we truly see that conditioned existence is not permanent, it cannot ever be satisfying, and that we have no separate, unchanging self. We will leave behind views that Bhante describes as attitudes as deeply rooted almost as sentient experience itself. Then we'll experience insight, the dropping away of the most universal assumptions and the most pervasive paradigms of all. And this can only happen when we become completely unattached to paradigm. We realise that no paradigm is true, and we see things as they really are. Thank you.